Hello, my name is Dave Emery. Welcome to this next segment. In this segment, we're going to be talking about a recent development with regard to not only the Middle East, but Iraq in particular, the defection of Kamel Hussein, or also Hussein Kamel. One will see his name portrayed both ways, as we shall see. He defected. He has basically turned against Saddam Hussein, his father-in-law, and obviously head of state of Iraq. And the resulting effects of his defection have been basically to oblige, apparently, the Iraqi government to begin disclosing more information to the United Nations about the extent of its development of weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. Kamel Hussein was not only in charge of Iraqi weapons procurement and arguably the most powerful man in Iraq after Saddam Hussein, he also was in charge with the development of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. The San Francisco Examiner of Monday, August 21st of 1995 discusses some reports of the imminence of an Iraqi nuclear test. This story is an AP story, Dateline London, headlined Gulf War Thwarted Nuke Test by Iraq. It's subheaded Bomb Reportedly Built, Defector Claims Second Kuwait Invasion Planned Recently. The article reads in part, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein was within 3 months of testing an atomic bomb when U.S.-led allied forces launched the Gulf War to liberate Kuwait, according to a published report. The London Observer quoted sources close to an American team responsible for debriefing Hussein's son-in-law, the architect of Iraq's advanced weapons programs, although Washington has not officially confirmed any dialogue with Lieutenant General Hussein Kamel al-Majid, M-A-J-I-D. He defected to Jordan August 8th with his brother and their wives, both Hussein's daughters. If confirmed, the Observer report would mean that Iraq had already finished building a bomb and was on the brink of testing it when its army crossed into Kuwait. More about the Iraqi advanced weapons program, including weapons of mass destruction, not only its burgeoning nuclear capability, but also its chemical and biological warfare capabilities, and also the development of missiles, which would be capable of delivering these particular weapons. The New York Times of Wednesday, August 23rd, has a story by Barbara Crossett, C-R-O-S-S-E-T-T-E. It is datelined the United Nations, August 22nd. It's headlined, Iraq supplies UN with new details on germ weapons, poison-armed missiles. Documents show an arsenal bigger and more advanced than admitted in the past. The article reads in part, Iraq has told the head of the United Nations inspection team that its germ warfare program was larger and more advanced than it had previously admitted, including bombs and Scud missiles armed with lethal biological agents, officials of the team said today. In weekend meetings with the United Nations official Rolf Ekus, E-K-E-U-S, the Iraqis provided new details of stockpiles of germ weapons that included substantial quantities of anthrax, botulin, and other agents. Skipping down. But some diplomats and officials say they are concerned that Iraq may still have biological weapons stored at secret sites. Although Iraq had previously confessed to having both toxic agents and warheads, the inspectors said the fact that the warheads had been armed indicated the weapons were much closer to being used than previously known. Quote, now they admit that these types of agents have been put on ammunition, including missile warheads, on bombs, and this is, of course, a major admission, unquote, Mr. Ekus told reporters after his visit to Iraq. Again, quoting, that means also that the Iraqi weapons program was very much advanced, unquote. Skipping down again, Mr. Dilfer described the Iraqi biological weapons program as, quote, very significant, advanced, mature, and a threat to the region. By the way, Mr. Dilfer, D-U-E-L-F-E-R, is Mr. Ekus's secretary. Skipping down still again in the article, the new admissions by the Iraq government were apparently prompted by the defection to Jordan earlier this month of a son-in-law of the president, Lieutenant General Hussein Kamel Hassan, H-A-S-S-A-N, who had been responsible for developing Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Officials say that the Iraqis appeared to want to preempt General Kamel, whom Mr. Ekus met today in Amman, where he was given asylum on August 8th. By revealing information that General Kamel was likely to provide anyway, Iraq may hope to win favor for being forthcoming, and thus advance Mr. Hussein's campaign to end international sanctions against his country. Skipping down again, In talks with Mr. Ekus over 4 days, the noticeably tense Iraqis tried to blame General Kamel, who defected with his brother Saddam Kamel Hassan, another son-in-law of the president, for concealing information from the United Nations, which made the destruction of Iraqi weapon systems a prerequisite to the lifting of wartime sanctions on Baghdad. In a final, almost comic encore to the Ekus' visit, Iraqi officials escorted him to the airport for a flight to Bahrain on Sunday, detoured to a rural home where they said General Kamel had stashed documents whose existence the Iraqis have been denying for years, and skipping down again. At Harvard University, Matthew S. Messelson, M-E-S-E-L-S-O-N, a leading expert on germ warfare, said scientists' suspicions had been aroused in the late 1980s when Iraq approached two companies in Europe about devising a warhead with a restraining parachute for its Al-Hussein missile. Deadly anthrax particles, which can kill people or animals that inhale it across several miles, must be released close to the ground to be effective, Mr. Messelson said. It needs a slow-moving delivery system. Botulin, which he described as the most poisonous protein, must also be inhaled. It attacks the nervous system. Anthrax attacks the body's cells. One of the things that is quite ironic about this latest development in the Middle East is that General Hussein Kamel is, or Kamel Hussein, take your pick, is in a very interesting position. He not only was in charge of the Iraqi weapons and procurement program, including their advanced weapons, but he also was interfacing directly with American national security and intelligence people who, under the auspices of the weapons transfer program that later became known as the Iraqgate scandal, or should have become better known as the Iraqgate scandal, tragically it has not received the press it deserves, of the role of the U.S. national security establishment and the Reagan and Bush administrations in the arming of Iraq, although later George Bush and his administration turned against Iraq, obviously. The tilt toward Iraq, which resulted in the illegal and massive weapons transfer program to Iraq during the Persian Gulf War, that, by the way, accomplished under the auspices of some interagency governmental networks that grew directly out of recommendations stemming from the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, that Vice President, by the way, being George Bush, and as we've seen in past broadcasts, including Radio Free America Program number 38, those interagency government networks basically functioned as sort of a private intelligence service for George Bush, of course, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. We're going to proceed into a two-segment series, in which we are, first of all, going to examine the role of General Kamel, or Hussein Kamel, or Kamel Hussein, in the Iraqi weapons procurement program, and we're going to view in considerable detail his work with the Reagan administration and U.S. national security officials who were the primary element in the arming of Iraq. Many other countries fed at that particular trough as well, but the role of the Reagan and Bush administrations and the U.S. elements of the U.S. national security establishment in the arming of Iraq, the significance of it, I should say, could not be exaggerated. We're going to begin by taking a look at the U.S. role, or elements of the U.S. role, in the Iraqi weapons transfer, again later known as the Iraqgate scandal, and we're going to rely for our information on the book The Spider's Web by Alan Friedman, subheaded The Secret History of How the White House Illegally Armed Iraq. Alan Friedman, a prize-winning reporter for the Financial Times of London, has written arguably the best book on the Iraqgate scandal. It was published by Bantam Books and copyrighted 1993. We are going to be detailing the roles of a number of different players in the Iraqi weapons transfer, a.k.a. Iraqgate. A fellow named Larry Hickey, a businessman, an American businessman with extensive national security connections. A fellow named Fred Haubsch, H-A-O-B-S-H, and I'm not sure on the pronunciation of that. Mr. Haubsch was a Middle Eastern businessman. He not only did business in the Middle East, but was of Middle Eastern extraction and spoke Arabic. He worked with Larry Hickey and also two CIA assets named Robert Johnson and Richard Smith. As we're going to see, some of the first contacts of Messrs. Haubsch and Hickey with Hussein Kamel, took place under the auspices of Robert Johnson and Richard Smith, who, acting as agents for operatives for the U.S. national security establishment and CIA, were pivotal in much of the Iraqgate transfer. We're going to see, too, the role of the apparent role of administration officials, including William Casey, director of the CIA, his close associate Robert Gates, also the agency, Reagan National Security Advisor William Clark. And we're going to take a look at information from Robert Johnson, as relayed by Alan Friedman in Spider's Web, that his marching orders came directly from the White House. We're going to begin by taking a look at the introduction of Fred Hauptsch to Robert Johnson and Richard Smith and their organization, Johnson Consultants, obviously a firm that operates on behalf of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. Of Fred Hauptsch and his introduction to Johnson Consultants and its operatives, Richard Smith and Robert Johnson, Alan Friedman writes as follows in Spider's Web. From the outside, the offices of Johnson Consultants, worldwide marketing consultants in Northern Virginia, were no different from 1,000 others in the 5-mile wall of glass facing Washington across the Potomac. The principals, Richard Smith, Chief Operating Officer, and Robert Johnson, President, fit easily into the community whose lifeblood is government business, public, or private. Skipping down, in neighborhood parlance, Johnson and Smith were longtime agency people. Not on the staff of the Central Intelligence Agency, but like hundreds of others in the loose-knit fraternity, placed under contract from time to time to perform operational assignments either personally or through one of their handful of nebulous-sounding corporations. As we shall see, Robert Johnson and Smith and Johnson Consultants obviously acting as an intermediary for CIA and elements of U.S. intelligence, institution and those people played a primary early role in the Iraqi weapons transfer. And note, please, throughout the segments I'm reading from Spider's Web, the ubiquitous Hossein Kamel from Spider's Web, we read, given the public pronouncements of neutrality by the new administration, direct involvement of the CIA or any other government agency was officially out of the question, quite apart from the fact that severe penalties in law precluded any unauthorized military trade with Iraq. Nevertheless, while Iraq might officially be a pariah state to counter Iran's offensives, the White House seemed quietly to let it be known that Iraq needed help with whatever armaments could be provided in the so-called gray market and as soon as possible. At American Steel in New York City, Larry Hickey had already picked up on this rumor by the time Hossein Kamel paid him the visit in March. And after Hickey and Hauptsch returned from Baghdad in April with Hossein Kamel's weapons wish list, it was only a question of time before the two men found themselves working Hickey's contacts in the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. On December 2nd, 1981, not long after making his deal in Rio, Fred Hauptsch walked with Hickey into the fourth-floor office suite of Johnson Consultants in Virginia. Hauptsch, who had been told little about the firm by Hickey, was expecting the usual chat with a couple of executives who had contacts in the right quarters. He would come away stunned. Skipping down, the man whom Hickey had come to see was Robert Johnson. It took Hauptsch no time at all to understand that he was sitting out opposite a player of substance. Johnson's comportment implied army, but his manner of speaking implied government. Indeed, to the knowledgeable, it would suggest intelligence services. He never said more than he needed to, and he tended to listen far more than he spoke. The only thing striking about him was his piercing blue eyes. Johnson had many friends in the Pentagon and at the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Bragg was the home of the legendary Delta Force of the Navy SEALs and the Green Beret. Johnson also had excellent connections with military suppliers and represented a number of companies that made bomb fuses, artillery pieces, and other items that form the stock in trade of an arms merchant. According to Pentagon officials and intelligence agents, Johnson was also on very friendly terms with Robert Gates, the CIA man who was now rising steadily at Langley as William Casey's protege. He was clearly someone who could count on friendships and contacts at even the higher levels of government. And skipping down again of Robert Johnson and his work on Hossein Kamel's billion-dollar shopping list, the recently defected Hossein Kamel, or Kamel Hussein, Robert Johnson sat back on his chair that winter afternoon and scrutinized Hossein Kamel's billion-dollar shopping list. He ran through the items with his partner, the missiles, the defense electronics, the tanks, the helicopters, and more. No problem, said Johnson. Hauptsch continued to associate with Johnson and Smith in the months that followed. In early 1982, he began to suspect that his value to them was less as a colleague than as a legman, one who spoke Arabic and knew his way around the Middle East. Still, quote, After a few meetings, they loosened up a bit, unquote, said Haupt years later, recalling the way he had been drawn further into the plan to fill the billion-dollar shopping list. Johnson and Smith finally told Haupt they were ex-CIA. As we've seen in numerous past broadcasts, the concept of an ex-CIA agent is always a questionable one. It remains to be seen in such cases whether the individual retains under-the-table contacts, a process known as sheep-dipping. Continuing, they also introduced him to their lawyer, another former agency man. In fact, the lawyer had been a long-time operator in the smoke and mirrors world of government special operations. Haupt's most visible recollection of the lawyer was the way he constantly reminded them that the word Iraq should not be used even in conversation. The word Jordan should be submitted, even though we all knew where the goods were going. By the way, Jordanian end-user certificates were used to mask these transactions. Bear in mind that it is to Jordan that Hussein Kamel and Saddam Hussein's other son-in-law have defected, along with their wives, Saddam Hussein's daughters. Bear in mind also that, as we are seeing, Hussein Kamel has long-standing contacts, or has had, with the U.S. National Security Establishment. Whether those have been revived, whether there is a covert operation of any sort underway in August of 1995, remains to be seen, and if so, it remains to be seen how successful it is. Continuing with Spider's Web. Hussein Kamel, dressed in civilian clothes, welcomed Haupt to Baghdad and apologized for the delay in meeting him. Then he introduced the military figure at his side, Lieutenant General Shenshel, S-H-E-N-S-H-E-L, the Army Chief of Staff, and without delay, the three men were driven with military escort to Hussein Kamel's office in the presidential compound. For the next 2 hours, Haupt set out his good news in detail. It had taken most of a year to put this deal together, he said, but finally, with the help of non-government contractors with CIA backgrounds, it would be possible to fill the shopping list. Once friendly officials in Jordan agreed, shipments would come into Amman for onward transit to Baghdad. Training on the American equipment would be arranged through Jordan. As long as they carried Jordanian passports, Iraqi pilots might even be trained within the United States. That was a matter still to be dealt with. Haupt would come to Baghdad as often as necessary, while details of the entire package were being finalized. The men finished their Turkish coffee and embraced. Then, as Haupt turned to leave, Hussein Kamel drew him aside and explained that there was somebody he needed to meet. The two men stepped out into the sunshine and walked together across the compound to the palace, passed through two antechambers, and arrived in a large but rather undistinguished room. Seated behind a dark wooden desk was Saddam Hussein. He rose immediately and walked across to Haupt, and they embraced in greeting. There was no small talk. In formal language, Saddam expressed his thanks for the work Haupt had done on behalf of Iraq, then gestured to an aide who approached Haupt and pressed a small suede pouch into his hand. The audience was over within 3 minutes. And as we shall see, this particular operation, obviously a national security operation involving the Central Intelligence Agency and quite obviously the Reagan administration, later at least for a period of time the Bush administration, the weapons transfers quite obviously were sanctioned from on high in the Reagan administration. Returning once again to Spider's Web, for many months now, Johnson had given very little away to Haupt about the invisible source of support that made it possible for him to travel back and forth to Baghdad and to organize the sale of U.S. arms to Iraq. With the help of Jordanian end-user certificates. The question had been left hanging. By the summer of 1982, Haupt wanted an answer. Nobody he had met in this enterprise foresaw jail time in their crystal ball, Haupt said to Johnson. So who was behind all this? Johnson vaguely mentioned the White House and the CIA, but he did not name the expediters. Only after Haupt pressed him on several more occasions did he eventually get some names. The first one mentioned was William Casey, who had been to visit the Saudis and had relayed back to Washington their urgent advocacy of arming Iraq quickly and heavily. Then there was Robert Gates, Casey's deputy director for intelligence. Another name was Judge William Clark, the national security advisor to President Reagan. Casey died in 1987, but a former cabinet member who worked with him recalled, quote, A lot of such activity and some hurry-up requests for arms from Casey, unquote. Gates has repeatedly denied he was involved in any covert operations to arm Iraq, and William Clark has said he has, quote, no recollection, unquote, of any involvement either. As for Robert Johnson, he was extraordinarily concerned about being named in public, but he was willing to confirm that his marching orders came, quote, directly from the White House, unquote. Let's take just a minute to sum up what we've been looking at. By the way, of the role of the interagency governmental networks that grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, there's a very good account of that in the book The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Loftus, a former career military officer and then Justice Department investigator with the Office of Special Investigations that was charged with hunting down Nazi war criminals in the United States. He came across many of the U.S. intelligence Third Reich espionage networks that existed in the Cold War period and that, to a certain extent, still bear significant influence on the United States. That particular book is published in the hardcover by St. Martin's Press, and it is still, as far as I know, available in August of 1995. In fact, it is still available. There's also a very good four-part interview, 2 hours total, with John Loftus that is available from archives on audio, about which I'll have more to say in a moment. We began by examining some of the recent news about Iraqi advanced weapons and weapons of mass destruction development, apparently more advanced than had been told. We have been hearing about just how advanced the Iraqi nuclear effort had been. We are also hearing now about how advanced their chemical and biological warfare program had been and about how CBW munitions had actually been mounted on missile warheads, missiles envisioned as being among the many delivery vehicles for the weapons of mass destruction. We then began accessing information from the book Spider's Web by Alan Friedman, dealing with the profound U.S. role, U.S. intelligence role, and Reagan and Bush administration role in the Iraqi arms transfers, those conducted on an intimate basis, Hussein Kamel, or Kamel Hussein, one of Saddam Hussein's brothers, sons-in-law, who recently defected to Jordan, the country that was used as a conduit, one of many, by the way, for the Iraqi weapons transfers, U.S. intelligence and the Reagan and Bush administrations being pivotal in the arming of Iraq. We took a look at the role of Larry Hickey and Fred Haupt, working with a couple of CIA cutouts named Robert Johnson and Richard Smith and their business, Johnson Consultants. We took a look at the intimate role of Messrs. Haupt and Hickey, their meeting with and dealings with Hussein Kamel, also the interface, obviously an intimate and profound one, between Johnson Consultants and Hussein Kamel. Jordan was used as a country of conduit for the various weapons. And we have also seen how these transfers were quite obviously, albeit clandestinely, sanctioned from the corridors of power in not only the U.S. National Security Establishment and CIA, but also the administration of Ronald Reagan. During the course of the program, I've made reference to archives on audio. That's a tape duplication service that stocks all of the archive shows. The archive shows are a form of radio documentary, similar in form to this program, in which printed sources are read on the air, literally extracted on the air, so that listeners can tape the programs and use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. All of these archive shows are on permanent file at Archives on Audio. More about that right now.
Tape cassettes of Dave Emery's archive documentaries and weekly One Step Beyond programs are available from a tape duplication service. The service is Archives on Audio, and you can contact them at Post Office Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. Once again, that's P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number and area code are 415-346-1840. A 12-page catalog listing and describing each archive show is available.
That, by the way, is now a 20-page catalog, and neither myself nor the station gets money out of this arrangement. It is FYI. Also, many of the titles that I use on these programs, including Spider's Web, are available from a book search service called Antifa Book Service. That's A-N-T-I-F-A. They can be contacted at 945 Taraval Street, Taraval Street, number 117, in San Francisco, California, 94116. Once again, that's Antifa Book Service, ANTIFA, 945 Taraval Street, Taraval, number 117, San Francisco, California, 94116. Contact them for books on this particular field of research, and they do have Spider's Web. In the next segment, we're going to take a look once again at the profound U.S. role in the Iraqi acquisition of weaponry. And in the next segment, we're going to take a look at Hussein Kamel and his interface with not only officials of the Reagan administration, but U.S. National Security Establishment and CIA in order to procure weapons of mass destruction. We're going to take a look in particular at the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, an Italian commercial bank, bank whose Atlanta branch was used as a major conduit for billions of dollars that were sent to Iraq, channeled to Iraq, to finance their weapons program, including their weapons of mass destruction, and in particular the delivery systems for same. As we shall see, Hussein Kamel worked very directly with elements of the Reagan and Bush administrations and the U.S. National Security Establishment, as well as American industry, to obtain some of the very weapons that the Iraqi government is now revealing information about. Following the defection of Hussein Kamel and another of Saddam's sons-in-law to Jordan, again, the country, one of the countries used as a conduit for these weapons. That concludes this particular segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.